1997 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 121. Still peculiar after all these years. Mormons through the eyes of non-Mormon novelists. By Sharon Larson and Robert G. Larson. With comments by John Sillitoe.
Some people of his own and God's own people. So if King James had just waited a few years or had not hired the most conservative scholars he could find, we Mormons might be not have to worry about this phrase at all, as we grow in peculiarity, which is property, and become less peculiar, which is strange, we run in danger of becoming not peculiar, chosen. So, but if this could have all been avoided. A number of writers have attempted to document our attempts to shed our strangeness. From the issuance of the manifesto in 1890 to the 1950s, we worked very hard to accommodate to and be assimilated by the culture which surrounded us. In Mormonism in Transition, Tom Alexander writes, between 1890 and 1930, the Mormon people made the transition which integrated them as fully into the national culture as into national politics and the national economy. Armin Moss has put a sociological spin on this in The Angel and the Beehive. The appearance of such conspicuously deviant and unpopular a new religion or social movement presents a challenge to the normative order of the surrounding host society. If survival is the first task of the movement, the natural and inevitable response of the host society is either to domesticate the movement or to destroy it. The society will apply various kinds of social control pressures selectively in an effort to force the movement to abandon at least its most unique and threatening features. To the extent that the society succeeds in this domestication effort, the results will be the eventual assimilation of the movement. He adds that if the movement is to survive and prosper, it must succeed in maintaining indefinitely an optimum tension, and adds, if in its quest for acceptance and respectability, a movement allows itself to be pulled too far toward assimilation, it will lose its unique identity altogether. Mormon leadership, in Moss's opinion, recognized that in the 1950s, the church was moving too close to what he calls the assimilative embrace of the surrounding society and began a form of reversal of evolutionary direction, a partial retrenchment back toward a more sect-like posture accompanied by some increase in tension with the rest of North America. Mario DePellis sees another threat to what he termed the Mormon community or peoplehood. He pointed out in a 1991 Sunstone article that many American social institutions faced fundamental changes in the 1960s, but that one, peculiar to the Mormons, his phrase, was a decline in the old anti-Mormon persecution that drew the saints together for so long. He adds that after about 130 years, the decline and disappearance of persecution may weaken that old cement of the Mormon community, paranoia. I frequently wonder if this policy reversal was necessary. For one thing, not all of the accommodation was one way. If in the 50s my family looked very much like those other families in the Ladies' Home Journal with its motto of togetherness, it was due in part to the pervasive concern for home and family that most Americans experienced after World War II. In retrospect, it appears that the changes in American social structure in the 60s, the anti-government feelings caused by the Vietnam War, the generation of love, you all know what those were, all those elements that Theodore Roszak termed the counterculture, would have emphasized our difference if the church leadership had taken no action at all. At this point, when I was writing, I would get a total block because I wanted to stop and rant about the whole process, and I finally realized that this has to be for another paper. I can't do that today. So however valid or invalid the reasons for the policy reversals in the second half of the 20th century, we seem to be heading into the 21st century secure in our peculiar status. Bob and I found this peculiarity reflected in three novels, all published in the 90s by non-Mormon authors, which deal either directly or indirectly with Mormonism. All three authors managed to overcome Wallace Stegner's lament in Mormon Country. It is almost impossible to write fiction about the Mormons for the reasons that the Mormon institutions and Mormon society are so peculiar that they call for constant explanation. What do they find strange? They seem primarily to focus on our history and our doctrine, and where those two meet, it's really wonderful. I mean, how can they resist plural marriage and blood atonement? They focus also on the word of wisdom and on obedience to authority, with an emphasis for some reason or other on dress code. I was surprised that outside of the discussions of polygamy, there was remarkably little attention paid to feminist issues. At last night's session, it sort of dawned on me that all three authors have one character, at least, who is searching for order in her, they're all three women, in her life through the Mormon Church, which I thought was an interesting thing. Particularly jarring to Mormon readers is the inability of outsiders to get it quite right. Understanding obedience, for example, is difficult for outsiders, and there's a tendency to create characters who are stereotypes. They're either totally obedient or totally rebellious. Language is a major problem. In an article on testimony bearing, a comparatively formal use, Mormon use of language, also in a 1991 Sunstone, David Knowlton writes, "Mormons may not have a bound canon of prayer, an approved prayer book from which we read and repeat at our meetings. Neither do we have a testimony book from which we read and repeat, but we do have an extraordinary, complex, unwritten formality that all of us learn and which we use to evaluate each other's testimonies. Unique usage is not limited to formal situations. In the Sunstone article cited earlier, Omeria DePillis writes, Mormons have given up geographical isolation, but their speech and literature is permeated with a special rhetoric and vocabulary. Several years ago at Sunstone West, there was a session on Mormonism and science fiction, and Karen Rosenbaum suggested that one reason for Scott Card's ability to reach a mainstream audience while using Mormon speak is that people expect strange names and strange jargon in science fiction. Mormons recognize the source, and non-Mormon readers of science fiction don't mind it. As Mormons, we feel dissonance when our terms, formal or informal, are used incorrectly by outsiders. Sometimes the distinctions are pretty subtle. We can't figure out what's bothering us. For a quick example, in Peter Rock, whose book, This is the Place, Bob Will Review, grew up in Salt Lake, and he talks the talk pretty well. But on page 117, he writes, Charlotte had been to the temple the first week in the city, and the city's Las Vegas. She'd been afraid and felt drawn there, believed it might be closer to where she belonged. And if you're a Mormon who's been reading so far, you know Charlotte's not going to the temple. Charlotte's going to the temple grounds or to the visitor center. And it's really bothersome for a Mormon. And it took me maybe two readings to figure out why that particular phrase bothered me so. Enough talk now. Let's have the three novels. As Henry said, Bob will review Red Eye, then I'll do Recipes from the Dump, and then Bob will do Peter Rock's This is the Place, and we have promised not to interrupt each other unless we absolutely have to.
I met Clyde Edgerton at a book signing for Red Eye. Notices for the signing said that Edgerton had actually met a Mormon bishop, implying that this was quite a unique event and that the book would be more authentic because of it. At a book signing, you have about 30 seconds to discuss things with the author, so I asked Clyde Edgerton about the bishop. He said that he had met the bishop. He didn't add anything to it, and I noticed in his foreword, he gives gratitude to a number of people, one of whom might be a bishop, but he also mentioned Juanita Brooks as a person who contributed to his book, but it was in a time in, she's been incapacitated since about 1983 and died, and so he was referring to having read Mountain Meadows Massacre rather than having consulted directly with Juanita. Mountain Meadows Massacre took place in southern Utah in 1857. Red Eye tells a tale of revenge against a prominent participant in the massacre, Bishop Thorpe, set in Colorado in 1892. Cobb Pittman and his dog, Red Eye, are the avengers. At first casual reading, I found it a convoluted tale filled with droll characters in a carnival setting in the West that left me curiously uninterested in the fate of the main characters. Edgerton's other books, the most notable being Walking Across Egypt, are convoluted tales filled with droll characters in a southern setting. And while I was quite willing to accept these southern characters as authentic, the western characters seemed out of place. On subsequent, much more careful readings, it became evident that the novel was carefully crafted. The author writes first-person accounts from the viewpoint of many diverse characters. While changes in viewpoint are creatively interesting, it segmented the novel into a number of interrelated parts, and I think part of the problem with the book is this became too complex a task. It couldn't keep track of what the different characters were saying or thinking, and the main storyline got lost. So he writes deliberately while appearing to write spontaneously. His use of character, place, and voice is not haphazard. Why, I wondered, did he choose to place this most tragic event of Mormon experience in the carnival setting of Red Eye? The carnival setting appears in the book as excerpts from a promotional brochure for a tour to Mesa Largo. Here on Mesa Largo was the famous shootout between Bishop Thorpe and Cobb Pittman and the dog Red Eye. The brochure comes complete with fingers like that, pointing at important text. And I wondered, was Edgerton writing satirically, or was he, there's something subtle I was missing in the narrative, or was he trying to soften the emotional experience of Mountain Meadows? And all I can say is I didn't find any of these things. So I think that a powerful lesson that he could have written about the nature of good and evil and the capacity of men to be both was missed. Now, Edgerton could go into court and claim that his writing is very pro-Mormon. An example, I must say I was impressed with these two young missionaries, young gentlemen, especially as they compared with some of the more rustic cowboys who began appearing here and there as we continued west. I was impressed that the young Mormon missionaries in no way coaxed me unfairly, and isn't it such a great example of common sense to send missionaries to your own peoples, as well as to, say, China? Well, maybe that's not completely complimentary. The last sentence could be a stinger, or it could be sincerely meant. That's the trouble with Edgerton. Would a person who's naive about Mormons accept the statement as ridicule or good sense? In another statement, he says, they, the Mormons, are so clean and well-mannered, bringing, I hope, a religious stability to the entire unstable West. Another favorable statement has the Edgerton stinger. Even though the Mormon ways are sometimes odd, they do have a cleanliness and an orderliness that is comforting in a new country. And the new laws seem to have brought them to their senses about polygamy, thank goodness. There are several Mormon characters in Red Eye. Bishop Thorpe's ferry business is a thinly disguised Lee's ferry. Bishop Thorpe's wives are charming and industrious women. Actually, they are no longer his wives because they are also law-abiding women. There are some lesser characters in the novel. Zach Polson is a Mormon cowboy. Zach drinks, rolls cigarettes, and cusses. He follows few of the Mormon externals, yet he is clearly included in the Mormon group, although he feels alienated from the good Mormons in Beacon City. He has this to say, I remember the men and women in our church back when I was a boy. They was mighty good people, people that would give you the shirts off their back. Mighty good. I don't really know what happened at Mountain Meadows, and so that's my opinion on it. Mudfoot and Lobo are two Mormon Indians. They are the outside observers of the Mormon scene and act as a reality check on the goings-on of the white men. They're the two most likable characters in Red Eye. Like Zach, they drink whiskey, but they have a rationale for it. If Bishop Thorpe does not see us drink whiskey, then the one creator does not see us drink either. This sounds not a whole lot different from my Danish ancestors in San Pete County announcing that the word of wisdom was never intended for Scandinavians. Mudfoot explains the Indian position on being Mormon, once again with the Edgerton stinger present in the last sentence. The Mormons teach us about their maker and those spirits among them called their saints. We take the man who is the son of their creator spirit, the one called Jesus, into our hearts. We take the new Jesus, Joseph Smith, into our hearts. We take Moroni and Brigham Young and Wilford Woodruff into our hearts. Then we are able to live the afterlife. And if we accept what Bishop Thorpe teaches us, we will be given supplies. Mudfoot and Lobo also have a number of pithy comments from their Indian rather than religious perspective. Here is the best example. I believe the Mormons are so stiff that the blood cannot get into all their parts. They suffer because of this, but they never know they suffer. Mudfoot and Lobo are puzzled about the Mountain Meadows massacre and about the nature of the Mormon God. My people and our chief, White Deer, are under the power of Bishop Thorpe because of the supplies that the Mormons give to our people and because of the Mormon God that White Deer believes is the strongest and most feared of all gods. Now, this concept would find adherence among readers of the Old Testament, but the Indians add this. I have not understood the Mormon God ordering the Mormons to ask the Indians to do what they could have done themselves. Why indeed? There are three serious questions posed by Mountain Meadows Massacre. One, how did a group of clean and orderly Latter-day Saints allow this tragedy to occur? Secondly, if I had been there, speaking generically, would I have had the moral courage to stop it? And third, could anything like Mountain Meadows happen today? Edgerton deals with the first question in a standard historical way. Mormons were breaking United States laws. Johnston's army was sent to end this. The Mormons then refused to trade with any wagon train passing through Utah. Mormon leaders were preaching inflammatory sermons advocating blood atonement. The Mountain Meadows group became targeted for some reason. The Mormons told the Paiutes to wipe them out. After 3 days of fighting, three Mormons on horses bearing white flags offered to save the Mountain Meadows group. A 50-man escort was provided. At a signal, all adults and older children were killed. The small children that were saved were adopted by Mormons. The Mormons billed the United States government for the upkeep of the children. This account ignores the psychological conditions necessary for this event to take place. It ignores the tactical difficulties of keeping 50 people silent on the issue, and it ignores the strategic difficulties to come when it becomes known that the Mormons had participated in Mountain Meadows, and it caused the church a great deal of trouble. It removes the Mormons from the high ground of being the persecuted. Edgerton supplies only a short and inconclusive dialogue toward the end of the novel that deals with some of these issues. Bumpy Copeland asks Zach Polson, if the Mormons really done it and you'd been there, you think you would have helped them? Zach replies, Mormons didn't do it, the Indians did, or if we did, we had a reason. Zach adds, but I sure would have. You would have, too, if your father told you to. There are several essential conditions I would propose for a tragedy like Mountain Meadows to occur. There has to be a complete belief in authority by the participating person. An alternative is that the participating person has a completely passive personality. Such passivity is difficult for me to imagine in a normally functioning person. There must be a perception that the authority condones, permits, and demands violence in violation of conventional morals. This demand for violence may be defined situationally, that is, it may only be condoned in certain unusual situations. The situation of Laban and Nephi is a well-known example. 3, physical and social isolation contributes, but is not a necessary condition. 4, violence is deemed to be necessary to meet the demands of justice or necessary for the prevention of future problems, as in a peremptory strike. Potential dissenting voices must be physically or psychologically removed. The second question asks if I or any of us would have acted in any more moral way. I would like to think so, but my own self-examine reveals some disquieting ambiguity for me. Would I have become involved in Mountain Meadows? Probably not. I'm not that taken with authority. Would I dissent? Perhaps. But removing myself from the setting rather than open conflict is my typical style. If I realized a massacre was contemplated, would I openly dissent? I would hope so, but I can't say that I would have without question. Would I actively participate as one of the 50 escorts? No. To extend the analysis, would I participate in war? When I was younger, yes. Now, no. These are my personal responses, and I put them there. You might consider these on your own as your own personal responses. Because of his lack of analysis of why it occurred, Edgerton leaves open the question of whether Mountain Meadows could occur today. In his perception, this is an event in which good people run amok. Having run amok once, there's no reason to believe it couldn't happen again, which presumes a dark undercurrent underlying the Mormon religion. This is certainly not an attractive notion. I do not believe Mountain Meadows could occur in the present climate of the Mormon Church. Mormon authorities are preaching peace. A focused situation is not anticipated. Let's hope these conditions continue. As the church becomes larger and more competitive to Catholicism and Islam, this situation could change quickly. Only in the epilogue does the reader learn that Cobb Pittman, the vengeful killer of Bishop Thorpe, was himself one of the three riders bearing the white flags. Hence, the novel is one of expiation of guilt rather than simple revenge. This bit of information could easily be overlooked, as the epilogue looks more like a promo for another Edgerton book than it looks like it has anything to do with the present book, unless, of course, you read it carefully. And this is sort of the ultimate Edgerton stinger. Finally, Edgerton makes a comment that I interpreted to be his view of religion generally, even though it's couched in a Mormon context. They don't put up with no nonsense, said Uncle PJ. They won't even drink coffee. You don't want to take all the nonsense out of your life. You take all the nonsense out, and that ain't what a life is supposed to be. Don't you see that?
I very cleverly structured things so that I get to talk about the upbeat novel. Nobody gets maimed, mauled, or murdered in Abigail Stone's Recipes from the Dump. That's not to say all is well. The protagonist and first-person narrator, Gabby Fulbrighton, is teetering on the brink of full-scale depression. She has cause. She's a single mom trying to raise three children, one of whom is almost an adolescent. When this daughter is mad at Gabby, she goes to her room and writes long stories in which the mother dies, information, of course, which she's happy to share with her mother. Bill collectors hound Gabby. She's overweight. Builders are destroying the woods near her house to build new condos. Her neighbor and close friend may have breast cancer. Most distressing to Gabby, however, is the lack of a man in her life. Her house is on the road to the town dump, a partial explanation for the title. And on Saturday morning, she watches other women's husbands, all of whom seem strong and good-looking, haul trash down the road. The title also comes from her recipes like Earthling Junket, Dignity Divinity, and Perfectly Lovely Glacé. I want to give you a flavor for these recipes, so I'll give you a Mormon one. It's called Savable Soul Soup or Slip and Go Down. These are the ingredients. Somebody to come up with a new idea, a bunch of people to follow the rules, a list of righteous rules, an iron rod. To make slip and go down, add the new idea to the righteous rules and to the bunch of righteous people. When the people begin to separate, some will rise to the top and some will sink. Stir constantly so the sinkers don't stick together. Add iron rod to grasp onto, and after a certain unspecified amount of time, remove rod without warning. What's left in the pot is slip and go down. What clings to the iron rod is savable soul soup. Refrigerate savable soul soup and repeat process. Discard slip and go down. Gabby struggles hard to hold on. Her coping mechanisms include humor, Shakespeare, Ben and Jerry's, her strong sense of self-awareness, her concern for her children, the diet center, and the Mormon church. This novel is not about Mormons, although there is a Mormon strand, and it's the one I'm, of course, focusing on. There are also a New England strand, an ecology strand, a consequences of poverty strand, and even a Gulf War strand. They're all woven around the theme of the importance of caring relationships. Gabby writes about the church. Church is comforting, actually. There's a sense of family and of secret rites when you all get together in the church. The ripping of the bread, the little disposable plastic cups of water, the kindly eyes of the church leaders. Well, some of them look mighty scary. But the kindly feeling that permeates, the nods and hugs of the members who haven't seen you since last Easter, the intimacy of pew sitting. To be truthful, I was a Mormon for 2 years. Technically, I still am. They call me inactive because I don't attend Sunday services anymore. Gabby was baptized by Iggy Staines, an enthusiastic missionary whose pals were always requesting transfers to get away from him. But they wouldn't tell me why, she writes. They just said he was something else. I was living on a side street in an apartment in Leadbelly at the time as an innocent non-member when Iggy found me. Gabby was in part enticed into the church by Iggy's view of the eternal family. Through time and eternity. Now, isn't that a pretty neat promise? Would you turn down an opportunity to spend eternity with your mom and your kids? What about a husband, I asked. God has his plans. He's a pretty clever guy, and I think he'll find husbands for all our single sisters when the time is right. This interested me. She describes her baptism as somehow very erotic. It's like we were making love in front of all those people. And in fact, there must have been some erotic connection, because after his mission, Iggy keeps writing and calling Gabby, and first just hinting that maybe they should get married, and then finally he out and out proposes. She never answers these letters, or if she does, she never mails them. Later, she reflects on her active period. She says, "The Mormons are having a gathering at the church tonight. They stopped in and asked me to join them. They tried to entice me by saying all the women were bringing a different flavored cake. Get a box of Betty Crocker and make one and bring it," they said. My dog was growling at them, so I couldn't open my door all the way to let them in. Besides, my life looks so suspicious and unreligious anymore that I cringe when they drop by. At least our lives were cleaner then. There was an order to the chaos. There was a confined feeling. No coffee, no tea, no alcohol, no fighting, no swearing, no slothfulness, no thinking. She adds a rather scathing condemnation. But still, I feel more alive than when I was a Mormon. Another one of her observations led me feeling quite guilty about my own visiting teaching practices. Not long ago, a member of the Mormon Church stopped by my house. It was the Farm family from outside Leadbelly. They always sat in the back pews because they arrived late for sacrament meetings. They can't come till they do morning chores, someone had whispered to me. But even though I am inactive, members still stop by, hoping to bring me back toward salvation. So the Farm family stopped in after church. It was Fast and Testimony Sunday, and the children looked hungry, and I knew the mother wasn't drinking water because her mouth looked dry. I didn't ask them in. Grace and J.D. were boiling hot dogs on the stove, and I had a pot of coffee on the counter, so we stood in the front yard. We were just leaving church and decided to see how you were. We sure do miss you at church. Mormons are blunt people. They come right to the point, and then they stare at you with big round eyes or little squinty eyes, and you have to respond. They leave you no choice. Well, thank you. Is there anything I could do to help you come back to church? We could pick you up on Sundays if you like. It's no problem. We can swing around about 9:45. I looked at the ground. We have several new brethren, she said. Stone displays her awareness of peculiar Mormon vocabulary as Gabby thinks about this incident. The word brethren implies in itself a warm man in a raccoon coat. At least in my mind it does. It reminds me of the guy in McCabe and Mrs. Miller who loves the whore and wants to marry her, but she is an opium addict and goes off with some Chinese people in the end. The guy in that wore a raccoon coat and looked like the word brethren. In the Mormon church, though, it means men, plain and simple. Because so many of her observations are so accurate, I found particularly annoying those that weren't. For example, she refers to her children's misbehavior during, and this without irony, testimonial meeting. We live in a ward where travelogues often masquerade as testimonies, but we don't get many testimonials, so I was surprised at that use. The missionary Iggy Staines is an absolutely straight arrow, down-the-line Mormon, but he calls his companion Bill. Mormonism is not the cure for Gabby's depression. Her life continues to be full of buts. She'd like to marry Iggy, but not enough to answer his letters, or at least not enough to mail the ones she does write. She wishes we weren't using up all the Earth's resources, but not enough to separate the recyclable trash. She'd like to be like the Mormon women she perceives who keep their houses clean, their children clean, and often dress in outfits that match their scrubbed little daughters, but not enough to accept the church's constraints. The diet center actually has the most success. She loses 26.5 pounds, but when she regains one, she feels fat. What does or will or may save Gabby is her resilience. When near the end of the book, she receives an invitation to Iggy's wedding, her first reaction is, well, there goes my option. Her second is, but maybe polygamy will come back. She ends the book with a positive recipe called Life Juice. The ingredients are women and men and children, a planet, terrible sadness, great joy, a dash of unrealism, pinch of sex, and a cup of hope. Whip batter on high speed because this will heighten all desires. Cook in slow-burning oven because important things take time. Remove when done from heat and cool because nothing remains hot forever. End result will be a thin, cloudy liquid. You should not be able to see through it. If you can, add more hope and repeat process. Pour into Thorne's endless horn and drink and drink and drink. God bless.
The twistings and turnings of a tormented old man's psyche fill the pages of This Is the Place. An intensely personal account, the perspective is always from the vantage point of the old man. He is never given a name. In a few places, he is referred to as the old timer, a much too affectionate title. And in the one scene where he is addressed directly, he is called Pyro. All of the scenes in This Is the Place, are written in his first person account, even scenes where he is not present. Having a single vantage point does not lead to a more truthful account necessarily. Truth is limited to the degree to which the old man can be truthful with himself. He says that he is, and that the account is written to apprise the reader of certain events truthfully. This statement is by itself a part of the delusional system that he has, and is therefore false. The setting is the stark land of desert and immense white spaces of Wendover, Utah. The novel itself shimmers opaquely and with illusion like desert sand heat waves. The characters search for symbols and messages in the desert. Strange and inexplicable events take place. Are they in reality, or are they only in the mind of the old man? Not all is revealed at once, but like reality, events are revealed in bits and pieces. Some things are never revealed. The old man writes of portents of things to come. Like a good mystery, the facts are there but hidden. Like sinking into quicksand, it is easy to become entrapped inside the persona of this novel. How much of the work is an expression of Peter Rock's feelings, and how much the expression of what his character should say or think, as if the two could be separated, is a serious question for the reader. This Is the Place is not only a Mormon novel. Mormons appear in the novel because Mormons appear in Wendover. Mormons are part of the place. So are tourists, casino workers, marginal people living in trailer camps, Indians, and the Bureau of Land Management. Mormons are explained or examined only as the explanation is relevant to the interests of the old man. As it turns out, this interest is considerable. The old man is a dealer in a Wendover casino. He is also interested in gambling, and the book treats the motivation of gamblers about as much as it treats the motivations of Mormons. The book jacket suggests that the book examines the contrast of morality between the two. This Is the Place communities. The Mormon community of Salt Lake contrasted with the hedonistic community of Wendover, where a 65-foot metal and neon cowboy beckons, proclaiming, "This is the place." The old man writes, "I know their argument well. In Utah, you will learn morality and restraint, and you will yearn for everything you deny yourself. Here in Nevada, nothing is illegal, everything is permitted and encouraged, and will make you feel hollow. Believe me, the states need each other to recognize themselves, to savor the knowledge that there is an unhappiness more desperate than their own. Evil likes an audience, but good can't exist without one." The old man meets and becomes obsessed with a young Mormon woman named Charlotte. Neither Charlotte or anyone else in Rock's books has a last name. The novel is supposed to be about love, the old man for Charlotte. It's more about lust and about obsession and madness. The old man plots to bring Charlotte within his influence. Innocent gestures and common politeness of Charlotte are seen as significant events in Charlotte's enmeshment by the old man. Charlotte has a desperate unhappiness. Just what this is about is only partially clear. Doing baptisms for the dead seems to have been a peak church experience for her. Now she's dissatisfied. About what? The dullness of her parents, for one thing. Her sense of alienation and not being understood, for another. Charlotte is restless and trying to find herself. She goes to Wendover to count hawks in the sky and to be with her Aunt Anita, who may be a Mormon or who may not be. Charlotte could choose dullness, but she chooses risk instead in order to feel alive. In this novel, however, the risk is real and the result tragic. Charlotte's first typically Mormon action is attending fast and testimony meeting at Wendover Ward. We are informed that Charlotte did not want to meet anyone. She only wanted to come to sacrament meeting to keep her strength. The old man writes, "Praying, she paid no attention to the service. She asked to know if she could trust the things she saw. She prayed to be called, to be singled out. She prayed not to end up like the women sitting behind her, weary, self-sacrificing, struggling to quiet their children. If she only listened right, she felt, she feared, she would truly believe, and she would not feel such dissatisfaction, such ambition." While Rock attempts to depict Charlotte as an insider looking at a Mormon meeting, her doubts and her sense of alienation from the others at the meeting change the vantage point to one of an outsider looking in. Rock's description of the testimony meeting is on a surface level of the words only. He does not depict the collective understanding and group cohesiveness building of testimony bearing, as Sharon mentioned in the David Knowlton article where this is discussed. The old man writes, "Now people were bearing their testimonies, standing to say, 'I know this church is true,' and then endless reasons why. The unexpected strengths found to deal with all of the little things that weren't predicted, the mundane surprises that make up a life." Rock thus adeptly describes most testimony meetings. The non-Mormon reader who does not know or surmise that other important things are happening in the meeting must wonder what persuades anyone to attend. While practicing Mormons will agree that testimony meeting could be one of the most powerful experiences in the church. Not finding satisfaction at church, Charlotte begins finding messages in the desert. There were words in the desert made out of stones and bottles stuck by their necks into the mud. They were not messages for her. They were only hearts and initials, obscene invitations. It was only later that she knew. She read her name spelled backward, east to west, stretching out, the letters separated by miles, all on the same black stones. No one else could have seen her name there. No one else could have found it. She was being called. I thought it intriguing that there might be a special message for me out in the salt flats, if I could just find it. I've talked about this with other people. I'm alone in being intrigued. I don't know what other people do when they drive across the salt flats, but so be it. The writer never learns if the messages exist in Charlotte's imagination, or if the old man placed them there, or whether the messages exist only in the delusional madness of the old man. For those who might be curious, Charlotte's message says, listen. Charlotte and her boyfriend Keith leave Wendover for Las Vegas. They are followed by the old man. In these transitory chapters, the old man reveals how obsessed and insane he really is, and he is found to be reading bodice rippers, gothic romantic novels. His fantasies about Charlotte are taken from the romances. Charlotte exists for the old man more as a character in a romance novel than as a real woman. I believe it is no coincidence the chapter in which the madness is revealed, along with the serious potential for danger, is the chapter that discusses the Mormon religion in most detail. The old man has been reading the Book of Mormon to better entrap Charlotte. Sharon thinks the old man might once have been a Mormon but isn't telling. I find no evidence for this possibility. While in Las Vegas, Charlotte becomes hardened to the ways of the world. She stops going to church. Strangely, she does not have sex with Keith, according to the old man, but does one time only with Texas, a hitchhiker the couple has befriended. Keith gives Charlotte a dress, which mysteriously shrinks in the night. It becomes for her a symbol of her lost childhood and is a sign. She remembers when it was her size, when it fit her. Charlotte and Keith move to Salt Lake. Charlotte goes to see the bishop of a nearby ward. Charlotte is combative with the bishop, even though her purpose is to talk about where she is and see if it corresponds in any way with the teachings of the church. She does not tell the bishop her last name. "Let's forget the dress for a minute," he told her. "Why don't you tell me what you've done wrong?" "What I think is wrong," she said, "or what I think you'll think is wrong." It'll be interesting to see the difference," he said. "Start with either one." Charlotte tells of her sexual contact with Texas. The bishop responds, "Often when we try to lift others up, we get pulled down ourselves." The bishop says she may be forgiven, but she has to show remorse. She has to try to change. "I had to do those things," she said. "Can't you see that? And of course, I am changing. I can't help that." Charlotte tells the bishop about the stones and the messages in the desert. The bishop becomes quite concerned. She did not answer his questions. She just listened to them multiply. By their heat, she could tell he suspected she was onto something true, and that he knew this and would not admit it, and he was afraid. The old man writes a philosophical aside about Charlotte and the bishop. "Delusions always belong to others. We cannot see our own. It's not so much that we see what we want to see, but that is what we have to see in order to survive." In a mystical novel such as This Is the Place, definitions are elusive. Rock writes about Mormons or not Mormons, sometimes interchangeably. An issue raised by this is to describe the essentials needed to be identified as a Mormon. This is not the same as the essentials needed to be a faithful Mormon. That's another matter entirely. I propose that minimum qualifications are: 1, you declare yourself to be a Mormon, and either, 2, you have been baptized a Mormon, or you are by heritage a cultural Mormon. Charlotte is a declared Mormon and is a Mormon by baptism and possibly heritage. She is a marginal practitioner, but not rebellious at the beginning. By the end, she has become alienated and combative. The Mormon religion has not been able to satisfy her or offer hope, a rather compelling indictment. I would sum up Rock's view of Mormonism concisely. Most of us live stupid lives. Mormons live orderly, stupid lives. Rock says, "This world was ordered, taken under control, so that the next one might be focused on, and it, too, forced to make sense, bent to the truth. Being sensitized to orderliness by Rock, I was startled to find this statement in a Family Organization publication. This is cited as a retelling by Heber J. Kimball, of a visit to the spirit world by Jedediah Grant. The order and government were there. When in the spirit world, I saw the order of righteous men and women, beheld them organized in their grade and order. I looked to see whether there was any disorder there, but there was none. Charlotte was disorderly. Sunstone's disorderly. A bad end comes to Charlotte." You'll have to read the book. "And I suppose a bad end will come to Sunstone. But I sense that Rock has an affection for individual Mormons, for their goodness and orderliness. in spite of his antipathy to the doctrinal and bureaucratic church. And what is there to be derided in an institution that produces such individuals?
Well, are we still peculiar? Do we need to keep working at it? I think the world still perceives us as peculiar. Not only did people write these novels, major publishers published them. They found us far enough from the mainstream to be interesting. So if being peculiar strange is a requirement for being peculiar chosen, indications are that we've accomplished this and there's no further need for retrenchment. I'm not convinced that the peculiar proposition even holds up, but most of the church leadership seems to believe in it. So can we expect a change? Probably not. They don't have time to read novels.
Okay, my name's John Sillitoe, and I'm going to quickly make some comments and hopefully leave a little bit of time for you to ask some questions. I'm pleased to be asked to participate in this session. The Larsons have given us much to consider, questions of order and obedience and authority and conscience and dissent, all wrapped within a critique of literature. I am certainly not a literary critic. What I'd like to do is really focus on two issues that these papers raise for me and perhaps for you as well. One concerns this question of accommodation and assimilation versus retrenchment. They sketch in the paper that between 1890 and 1950, the church went through a period of accommodation to the larger world, and citing scholars since the 1950s has entered into a period of reversal. And they conclude that the church seems to be heading into the 21st century secure in our peculiar status. Well, I'm not sure I agree with that assessment. I'm not sure I totally disagree either. I'm not sure which kind of peculiarity we're talking about, property, oddity, or exclusivity. I've always liked the quote of Dale Morgan that what happened in the 1890s was the kingdom of God was transformed into another among the many kingdoms of the world. Or as Bob Gottlieb and Peter Wiley wrote in their book America's Saints, Mormonism's most distinctive features faded into the past, and Mormonism would identify more and more with the America of the mainstream. Well, both of those people, Gottlieb and Wiley, and Morgan too, were writing about late 19th and early 20th century Mormonism. I'm not sure, really, though, that their critique is not as relevant today as it was then. One of the questions that these papers raise for me is, what flavor of peculiarity are we talking about? The flavor I'm most apt to see around here is vanilla. There's a sameness about this community. Is that, in fact, retrenchment? Well, or reversal? I don't know, possibly. There is a certain, and I use the term that Eugene England quoted to me the other night. I don't know if it's his creation or he borrowed it from somebody. He said, but Mormonism seems to be centered around a certain cultural correctness. And there is a lot of inside speaking about things. On the other hand, I see much homogeneity and mainline action and thinking, certainly in the corporate body of Mormonism. I had an occasion to read a couple of years ago now, right after it came out, the Pope's book, Crossing the Threshold of Hope. Sorry, it took me a minute to remember the title. With the exception of three or four very specific Catholic references to decisions made at the Vatican Council, etc., I couldn't find anything in that book that couldn't, or perhaps had, come across the pulpit in General Conference. Mormonism seems more and more mainline to me. Are we persecuted? I'm sure we still are. Is there a certain suspicion in the world about Mormons? Yeah. Does persecution and suspicion always dovetail together? People may be just suspicious against Mormons because, in fact, they are against all nonsense. Maybe if we were for more a little nonsense, there would be a little less suspicion. At the same time, I'm not sure, and I continue to be unsure, about what we mean by Mormonism. What is Mormonism when we talk about a Mormon history or a Mormon literature? It's certainly more than Utah, and it's certainly more than the United States of America. If the statistics in the recent Time magazine are accurate, there are more Mormons who live outside of the United States than live in the country. Well, what does that represent in, then, in terms of our worldview of what is a Mormon? Will it create a shift from that homogeneity, that vanilla flavoring I talked about a minute ago? Can diversity be correlated indefinitely? How will we celebrate the bicentennial in 2030, or the bicentennial of the Trek in 2047. I mean, what will the faces in those parades look like if, again, the statistics indicate that the face of Mormonism, no pun intended, is changing? And more importantly, will the jazz be in the parade? These are important issues to raise. The second important issue that the Larsons raise, and it's one that we could talk about at some length, concerns the state of Mormon fiction, or Mormons in fiction, or fiction by Mormons or Mormon watchers. Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I think much of what is said in these three particular books that they have talked about is inaccurate. A fair amount of it, however, I must say, rings true to me. They indicate that the authors focus on our history and doctrines. Well, again, recognizing the difficulty of terms, how different is that focus from the body of Mormon literature that is written by much more specific Mormon writers? Their same themes are the themes that Mormon writers in the last 100 years have looked at, plural marriage and missions and the Trek West. Well, I agree that there is a challenge to get it quite right. I think there's some great Don Marshall names in there. Don Marshall could come up with a missionary called Iggy Staines. We need to get it quite right, whether we're writing from the perspective of a Mormon, based on the definition that you provided, Bob, or a non-Mormon critic as well. Mormonism has produced fine writers, and I commend to you Levina Fielding Anderson and Jean England's book, Tending the Garden, as an example or as a resource to get some sense of that group. In that book, they summarize three different groups of Mormon writers, using the term of Edward Gary, who talks about the lost generation. Some fine Mormon writers, Virginia Sorensen and Maureen Whipple and Sam Taylor and Blanche Cannon and Richard Scowcroft. Gene finds a second group of Mormon writers that he calls faithful realists. Those are his terms. Now, I'm always hesitant to make lists of great writers, and I'm going to leave a few writers out, and if I do and it's one of your favorites, I apologize. At first I thought, well, I'll just list colleagues on the faculty of Weber or writers I've had children with. I broadened it a little more than that, okay? Levi Peterson and Linda Sillito and Judith Freeman and Don Marshall and Ron Molin and Doug Thayer and Daryl Spencer and Margaret Young are all representatives, among others, of that group of faithful realists. Well, I think there's a third generation of Mormon writers, Brian Evenson, Brady Udall, who is at this conference, both Mormon writers writing in part about Mormon experiences or writing from Mormon sensibilities, and both published by major presses, Knopf and Norton. Well, there are implications with all of this, I think, and implications that we can't solve or really discuss in great depth today. What is it to be a Mormon writer? Bob says, well, as a minimum, it's somebody that declares they're Mormonist or, in fact, has been baptized or comes from a cultural heritage. What is it to be a Mormon writer? I don't know if you know Utah Phillips, the IWW songwriter and singer, the golden voice of the great Southwest. He says any song an IWW sings is an IWW song. Maybe so. Is anything a Mormon writes or anything a Mormon sings or whatever a Mormon novel or a Mormon song? I don't know. How do we figure that out? How do we get some sense of it? The other implication, and if I had a little more time, I would share with you in at some length an essay that Judith Freeman published in a book called The Stories That Shape Us. It's not easy to write honestly within the Mormon context. And in this essay, she talks about, you know, the disapproval of her family, particularly her father. How do you write from within the fold and not make people unhappy with you? At one point, Judith gets an award from the Association of Mormon Letters from her for her book, The Chinchilla Farm. And so she writes to her father and says, well, how about this? Father says in a letter to her brother that it must have been a mistake. The award must have come from the Methodists, not the Mormons. He says, sadly, I have to inform you that your award doesn't come from the church and therefore does not indicate any approval of your book. I've been assured that the only books officially sanctioned by the church are the Book of Mormon, the Pearl of Great Price, and the Doctrine and Covenants, and not the Chinchilla Farm. Well, ultimately, Freeman and her father build that relationship back. But it's an essay that if you're interested in this topic and the implications of the topic, I really encourage you to read. In fact, it's a wonderful book. Well, I'm pleased to have had a chance to participate in this ongoing discussion. I'm sure we'll have more in future symposiums and in other places, and I'm sure the Larsons and others will be helping us understand the cultural world of Mormon literature that we find ourselves all very interested in. Thank you.